shotgun over there, telling me I got to beware. Take your time, we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds. So much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat.
Resistance calling, White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker. Yet, that's right, it's Saturn's Day. 6-6, June the 6th, 2015. Don't forget our P.O. box. Thank you for getting your donations for the show in and donations for POWs and so forth. We've been sending out some money orders to some POWs, and now we're sending out some books too, so got a pretty good source for books through Abe Books, A-B-E. A lot of those books you can get for $3 or $4, and that makes it pretty easy for me to send out some books to these prisoners, POWs, and even the guys who didn't go in there for that, who are wanting to get their mind right. Well, today is the big celebration, yeah, for hundreds of thousands of white men who died. Maybe more than that. Yeah, D-Day today. In fact, I had breakfast with a man, he's 92 years old, and my benefactor who wants, is sending me to Baby Jesus Land, and he was at D-Day on Normandy when he was 19 years old. Fortunately, he didn't go in on that first wave. He came in later, and so he didn't get blasted into kingdom come like so many others did. But it's nothing to celebrate, that's for sure, because, of course, World War I, we lost millions of white people, white men, women, and children all over Europe. Woodrow Wilson drug us into that one. There was absolutely no reason in the world to be in World War I. And, of course, World War I laid the framework and the basis for entry into World War II. So there you go. It's interesting how they talk about Normandy and on the beaches. They say, you know, well, they say, you know, we fought the Japanese, we fought the Italians, and we fought several people and during those days. And but when it comes to the Germans, it's always the Nazis. Well, why don't they call them, we fought the Germans? Because Germany was pretty much behind Hitler. There's no doubt about that. In fact, he was very popular, so it would include the whole nation in the fight. But they always say Nazi Germany, like a small party, which the Nazi party wasn't that big in Germany. they closed membership to it, and I forget what year. But it's obviously a ploy by the opposition and the crazy people and the elitist to keep that up there and then call anybody who disagrees with anything a Nazi. Yeah, right. Now, the other day I saw the battle plans for D-Day, a copy of the battle plans, and it was pretty obvious that it was a very complicated attack, and there was about three areas in this attack, and if any one of them would have failed, the whole thing would have collapsed, and all those guys, all of them, would have been killed on the beach. And of course, once they got over the hill, then they started killing Germans, white people. And so, isn't that wonderful? They still think World War II is a righteous war. Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it was, because there are a lot of things that led up to it. Like I've told a lot of Jews, I said, if you don't want the problems that you say you have, why did you support World War I? Why were you in deep in the armaments industry in World War I and in deep with the bankers who were spending the money and loaning the money out for World War I? If there hadn't been a World War I, there definitely would not have been a World War II. They look at you sort of, well, yeah, but they were the Nazis. Not in World War I. In fact, a whole lot of Jews were fighting on the side of Germany in World War I and II. And that's the story, of course, they don't like to talk about. Well, anyhow, I'm getting ready right now to skedaddle out of this place. And I'm going to go in my search for the baby Jesus. So I'm going to get on a big bird and fly and see what happens. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going early tomorrow morning. So I'm going to put something on here I think you'll like. Some of you might not like it if you still got a finger in Christianity, but, well, just turn off the radio and do something else if you don't like it, okay? And I'll be with you. In the meantime, any problems you have with the show or anything like that, or any copies of the show you want, anything like that, you get in touch with MerchandiseResist@yahoo.com, the webmaster, and she'll take care of you while I'm gone. So sending an email to me for the next 9 or 10 days, not going to do much good because I won't be reading it. So anyhow, salivies and sayonara, baby. We're going to the land of the Jesus people. Yeah, man. Well, I made a mistake there. I'm not going to run that religious stuff today. I'm going to run the thing about the New York draft riots, because I think it's pretty obvious that most of the country didn't want to, number one, they didn't want to emancipate the blacks, and number two, they really didn't want to go to war at all. Only the rich and powerful seemed to be excited about that.
In 1862, Abraham Lincoln announced that the Emancipation Proclamation would go into effect on January 1, 1863. New York responded by ousting Republicans from state offices, heightened their criticisms of Lincoln, and finally rioted against the draft in what became the worst urban rioting in history. The New York Historical Society presented a program about the emancipation and resulting draft riots. It's about 1 hour.
And now we turn to our third and final panel of this symposium, examining New York State's varying and often horrifying response to emancipation and conscription, the New York draft riot. And I think our panelists will not only help to make that era come alive again, but will add context to the events and actions that are so shocking that they continue to defy explanation and have done so for a century and a half. First, it's always an honor to share the stage with the Dean of America's Civil War Scholars, author of the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Battle Cry of Freedom, which arguably launched America's Civil War history renaissance, two-time winner of the Lincoln Prize, and most recently for Tried by War, Abraham Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief, Emeritus Professor of History at Princeton, the truly extraordinary industry known as James McPherson. And joining us is another very gifted historian who has made the New York City draft riots an area of particular expertise. He's the author of The Devil's Own Work, The Civil War Draft Riots, and The Fight to Reconstruct America, and also of The Battle for New York, The City at the Heart of the American Revolution, and Landmarks of the American Revolution. It's good to have this chance to restore his focus from that war to our war. He served as a valued consultant to the exhibit Lincoln and New York, and also wrote one of the essays in our catalog of the same name. It's a pleasure to welcome Barnett Schechter. Jim and Barney, welcome. I think to set the stage, we should try to understand how New York responded to emancipation. New York, the North, we've heard a lot about the proclamation today, and now we're drilling down to this area and to public response. Lincoln acknowledged complimentary editorials, but he also talked about decline in the stock market and troop desertion. What happened here in the newspaper offices, on the streets? Jim, let's start with you.
Well, I should defer to Barnett about this because he's written a wonderful book on the subject and knows more about it than I do. So he'll certainly come in and supplement and probably correct anything I have to say about it. Clearly, the New York draft riots did not take place in any kind of a vacuum. This was the culmination, in many ways, of 2 years of bitter political opposition to the Lincoln administration's war policies, and especially emancipation, conscription, the suspension of habeas corpus. The Democratic Party adamantly opposed the measures that Lincoln and the Republican Party thought were necessary to prosecute this war by 1863, which included all of the measures I just mentioned, emancipation, conscription, suspension of habeas corpus, made bitter and divisive political issues in various campaigns, the congressional elections of 1862, the New York gubernatorial and legislative elections in 1862, which placed a Democratic governor in Albany and a Democratic majority in one house, I believe, of the legislature. Governor Horatio Seymour and other New York Democratic politicians charged the Lincoln administration with tyranny, with despotism, with oppression of civil liberties in these measures, especially conscription and emancipation. So there is a long history of political divisiveness that lies behind the draft riots, and that comes on top of class and ethnic conflict, which were particularly strong, I think, here in New York City with this large immigrant population, especially Irish American. It's very large and strong labor class and labor movement. So you've got economic and cultural and political issues that created a kind of tinderbox here in New York City, and that gets exacerbated by the fact that New York City then, as today, was the media capital of the United States, with the most powerful and outspoken and aggressive newspapers on both sides or on all sides of these issues. The New York Times and Tribune on the Republican side, New York World, the leading Democratic newspaper, the New York Herald, a kind of maverick but mostly Democratic newspaper, which stirs up emotions as well. So you've also got a kind of level of rhetoric and one might even say demagoguery that exists at a more intense level here, I think, in New York than probably any other part of the country. So you've got a really volatile situation that takes all of these factors into consideration, and all it took was a spark to set this off.
Barney, drill down for us again even further about the what's happening on the streets and the boardrooms. And
right. You know, I appreciate what Jim said, giving us a kind of broad overview. And I think one of the, you know, the most toxic things that was going on in New York was, as you suggested, a linkage between race and class. And this had been a staple of Democratic politics, let's say, to pick a date, ever since maybe 1821, when they had allowed universal white male suffrage, and with the same stroke of the pen, increased the suffrage for black men to a prohibitive $250 property requirement. So this idea that the welfare of whites, particularly poor whites, would only be at the expense of blacks and vice versa, was something that was building for decades. And by the time you get to 1863, with the Emancipation Proclamation, suddenly politicians like Fernando Wood, for example, who, as Jim suggests, he also had a newspaper, the Daily News, published by his brother, so he had a mouthpiece, and they made this connection. What I would say was the spark that Jim referred to was really this idea that blacks are being liberated, they're going to come north, 4 million of them are going to come north and flood northern cities, and so they're going to take your job away from you. So labor competition was, I think, a focal point of this kind of cataclysm that we're going to see. And in the meantime, you're going to be sent to war. And the rich, who are allowed out of the draft for $300, the draft that was passed just on the heels of emancipation in March of 63, the ability of Democratic demagogues, as you put it so well, to link these two notions, that you're going to die on the front while the rich stay home and the black man takes your job, was a very powerful, corrosive message that really, I think, lit this tinderbox.
Jim, as we all observe the modern American Congress lurching, not passing anything in particular, tell us how the conscription law actually becomes the law of the land so quickly, even though it's obviously terribly controversial.
Well, the issue, I think, was manpower for the Union Army. In the first 2 years of the war, all of the Union soldiers, with a partial exception I'll mention in a moment, were volunteers, and the voluntary principle had existed in previous American wars. There had not been a national draft, a National Conscription Act, in the United States since the Revolution. But already in April 1862, the Confederacy had been forced to rely on conscription in order to maintain and increase the size of their armies, and so there was a precedent there. In the summer of 1862, Lincoln had issued a call for 300,000 more three-year volunteers. Eventually, those 300,000 and another 150,000 on top of that came forward. But at the same time, in the summer of 1862, Congress had passed a revised Militia Act, which extended the term by which state militia could be called into federal service from 90 days to 9 months, and had given the War Department the power to call on the states for a quota of 9 month militiamen and to impose a militia draft if, in fact, the states did not fulfill that draft, fulfill their quotas. And that actually happened in several states in the fall of 1862 after the War Department had, under this congressional legislation, called for 300,000 nine-month militia as well. So already in the fall of 1862, there was a great deal of divisiveness and even violence in resistance to this militia draft. That's actually what had called forth Lincoln's proclamation on September 24th, just 2 days after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, suspending the writ of habeas corpus in the entire country. And imposing martial law in the cases of resistance to the militia draft. And in cities as diverse as Milwaukee, Detroit, Cincinnati, Brooklyn, and other areas in the late summer or fall of 1862, there was already riots and violent resistance to the drafts. In some cases, again, even that early in these cities, there were attacks on the local black population. On the basis of what Barnett said, the idea that you're being drafted to fight a war to free black people who would then come north and take away your jobs, maybe marry your sisters, the whole bit, the whole thing went forward like that. So there was a long sort of history of debate about how to maintain Union armies, the question of equity, and who was drafted and who would be exempted was a divisive issue as well. And in the session of Congress that met in December 1862, expired in March 1863, the issue of the draft was one of the main issues debated by Congress, and again by a straight party line vote, Republicans in favor, Democrats almost unanimously against it, the Congress did pass the so-called Enrollment Act, which enrolled everybody from 20 to 45 males.
But no filibuster, no bulletproof majority.
Three-fifths majority there required. But it was a partisan major. Even if the Senate had required the so-called, 60 votes now, but it wouldn't have been that many then, the Republicans had that big a majority, yeah. And they could have passed it, and they did pass it by a straight party line vote. So it is something that Congress got done. But Congress did this in such a way as to try to make the draft as light as possible. It gave the president the authority to call for 3-year volunteers. It gave the each congressional district a quota to fill. And then after 50 days, if they had not fulfilled that quota, they would be subject to the draft just in that congressional district to make up the deficiency. So it was not universal. Military service by any means. It was a lottery for the draft. And in each of the 4 such calls for troops followed by the draft in the United States, about half of the congressional districts in each of them fulfilled their quota, often using big bounties to do it, without having to resort to the draft. So it was not universal. And the most controversial part of that was the $300 exemption. If you paid the $300 so-called commutation fee, you would be exempt from that particular draft call, not necessarily the next one. And the main reason for this, the ironic thing is that the $300 exemption became the most controversial part of the draft. Rich man's war, poor man's fight. Rich people could afford to buy their way out of the draft, poor people could not. But the main reason for that $300 exemption was because the draft, like the Confederate draft, also allowed a drafted man to buy a substitute to go in his place. Confederacy, and that had been true in militia drafts in the past, in states. And the purpose of the $300 exemption was to keep the cost of hiring a substitute from going out of sight, as it had already done in the Confederacy. So it was actually seen as a leveling measure on the part of the Republicans who passed it. But, of course, it became the most focused target of the opposition and resistance to the draft.
So we have, I think we've got the foundation of the scene that I'm going to ask Barney to set for a moment. In a moment, we have class and race tension. We have newspaper opposition, in particular strength in New York City. We have the draft law and the fatal flaw in the draft law, the substitute provision, which can be interpreted as another class statement. Straight Democratic Republican politics, the Emancipation Proclamation, the specter of migration, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, I mean, New York is such a mercurial town. New York, as most people in the audience are from New York will probably agree, can be celebrating one day and arguing and mourning the next day, come together in a crisis, separate over things that are not important. It's 'twas ever thus. But to set the stage, I think it's a useful reminder to recall that this ferment reaches explosive proportions only a few days after the Union has its most triumphant week of the war, arguably. At least Lincoln certainly says so from the window of the White House when he gives sort of a draft of the Gettysburg Address. Vicksburg falls. Gettysburg is enough of a major victory to be interpreted as a great epical war-changing event. It proved only the midpoint, as we know. But with all of this excitement, only a few days later, only 10 days later, this ferment occurs in New York City. I'm sure that it took Pete, even though there had been moments of tension in other cities, indeed riots, that it took Pete, the magnitude and the explosiveness of what happened in New York took the administration, the army, and city officials by surprise. With that further table setting, I wanted to Barney to sort of just walk us through the first day or so of what happens in New York.
Well, if I can just back up a few days.
Sure.
To even set it up even more.
To 1858.
Perfect. On the eve of July 4th, on the night of July 3rd, 1863, according to Horace Greeley, Republican Tribune editor, there appeared on the streets of New York an anti-government leaflet. It was signed Spirit of 76, and it was, you know, decrying denouncing the government in Washington and et cetera, Lincoln and so on. And Greeley's theory was that this flyer was a signal for the draft riots to erupt on July 4th, on a symbolic date claimed by Southern sympathizers as resistance to an oppressive centralized government, and so on. And that his theory was that the draft riots were supposed to explode in unison with Lee's invasion of Pennsylvania, and that Lee would be triumphant and then would have a fire in the rear to support his campaign, and then he would march triumphantly and capture Harrisburg, Washington, Baltimore, and even New York. That was the kind of conspiracy theory of the draft riots that actually the New York Times supported as well, because there was the sense that urban mobs would be kind of a tool in the Confederate war chest. The instability that they created in northern cities, the overcrowding. Remember, 800,000 New Yorkers, 500,000 of them packed into the bottom of the island, 12,500 free blacks, maybe 200,000 Irish, German immigrants. So again, an aspect of the tinderbox. But the theory then goes that when Lee was defeated at Gettysburg on July 1st through 3rd, this riot was postponed and erupted 10 days later as a kind of retribution or an effort to balance what had happened in the military sphere with something on the home front. In any case, the government also made a tactical mistake of starting the...
Well, tell us if you buy those conspiracy theories.
Oh, well, I wanted to leave you hanging. No. But my theory is that the draft riots were really too complex, too organic an event with all these layers of not only racial and class and political tension, but also religious strife between Protestants and Catholics. All these battle lines have been developing. It was not an event that you could replicate or instigate at will, something that, and as we'll see later in the war, in 1864, the attempt to burn the hotels, to instigate a riot at the Chicago Convention, these all suggest that the Confederates were trying to replicate what they saw happen during the draft riots, and we can document that they had sent agents to Canada and so on to do so, but it never really worked in the same scale because it didn't have those ingredients.
So that brings us to...
To what happened on the day of the lottery.
The turning of that draft wheel.
Yes, which we can see in the Luce Center.
Right in the exhibition.
Oh, it's in the exhibition now. I'm sorry. Again, the tactical mistake had to do with precisely that, starting the lottery on a Saturday, drawing some 1,200 names, and then having Sunday for these names to appear in some of the newspapers and for people to really get riled up and even to stockpile a few cobblestones and rifles and so on. By Monday morning, July 13th, by 3 or 4 in the morning, you had workers coming off of the docks, which, of course, in a maritime economy was a central business district, essentially, was shut down on the Lower East Side. They swept up from the machine yards, the shipyards, which made New York a manufacturing center on 14th Street on the East Side. And they swept up and gathered steam and became a huge mob around the southern end of Central Park, which was still under construction. And by 9 in the morning, these mobs had divided up and were moving downtown against their first target, which was the draft office at 46th Street and 3rd Avenue. And, one of the bits of evidence for conspiracy theory was that not only were they marching with placards against the draft, they were robbing hardware stores and using crowbars and other tools to chop down telegraph poles and telegraph lines to pull up train tracks, all suggesting some kind of preconcerted plan to really destroy the city in its entirety and to cut it off from potential relief either from, you know, by communicating with Washington or bringing in troops by train. And, you know, by the time the draft started, 46th and 3rd, a disgruntled fire company had arrived. They threw rocks through the window, ignited the riot, which burned down the entire city block, not only the draft office. And these mobs were able to just move downtown, barreling platoons of policemen out of their way as they searched for guns. And, of course, by the late afternoon on Monday, the 13th, this riot had already turned from a political protest and a work stoppage into essentially a racial pogrom against this small 12,500-member community of free blacks in the city who were, 5,000 of them were rendered homeless, penniless, and driven out of the city. And, of course, many of them were lynched and, murdered. And we don't know exactly how many, but there was a death toll of 105 for the riots, but it was probably closer to 500. For blacks, it may have been as high as 175, which is one figure that was cited.
In the end, I'd be interested in both your views about whether it's a draft riot or a race riot in the end, and how should history regard it?
Well, I'll take a stab at that first, and Barnett can again correct me. I think it was both. And it was also an ethnic riot. While there certainly were tensions between the Protestant establishment in New York City and the Irish Catholics, I don't think it really could be regarded as a kind of religious riot. But of course, religion is mixed up in ethnicity and in cultural conflict and even in class. So it was all of these things together, and I think that's what made it so toxic, as Barnett has said, is that it was not just one thing, it was many things that fed into each other. Let me make one other observation in response to your earlier point, Harold. There was an interesting kind of inverse relationship between Gettysburg and the Union victory there and the timing of the riot in New York City. When the Confederates invaded Pennsylvania, the northern governors, especially of Pennsylvania and New York, at the behest of the War Department, called out their state militias, the emergency militia, not the nine-month militia, but the emergency militias. And New York State, and especially New York City, responded very quickly and on a large scale to that call-out. And so nearly all of the militia troops that would ordinarily be in the city of New York in mid-July, we're in Pennsylvania, still part of the Gettysburg campaign, still part of the effort, which in the end failed, to catch the retreating Confederates before they could cross the Potomac River and inflict an even greater defeat on them. And so the New York militia was gone. It was 150, 200 miles from the city. And so there was nothing but the police force here, which performed heroically for the most part, I think, and suffered a lot of casualties themselves, to stop the rioters. Mm-hmm. Whereas if that had not been the case, if it had not been for the Gettysburg campaign and the absence of militia, there would have at least been the potential to suppress that riot in its early stages before it got out of hand.
So what I'm hearing is it's a perfect storm in many ways.
Yes.
Barney, why don't you tackle the race versus draft without... I'm sorry if I'm oversimplifying, but it's...
No, it's a great question. You know, it brings to mind Eric Foner's idea that the Emancipation Proclamation was really the opening of the Reconstruction era. And in that sense, I could describe the draft riots as really the first battle of that era, an anti-Reconstruction riot, an outcry against this torrent of social change that Lincoln had unleashed. It was fear, there was desperation, particularly among the Irish, who made up a large percentage of the working poor, working class in New York. There was a sense of a relentless feeling of persecution, having come from famine-gripped Ireland on coffin ships and being packed into the slums of New York, and then suddenly being told that they were going to have to go to war, while the rich stayed home. It seemed to them a kind of continuum of their sorrows. And so there was this sense of really rage against the idea that blacks would somehow be not only free, but given ultimately preferential treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was not only a competition for jobs, but all of a sudden know, we talked earlier today about Emancipation Proclamation opening the door to recruitment of blacks in the army, and suddenly there was the element of competition for glory on the battlefield, which is a very real thing. I mean, in the sense that the Irish had really bled terribly. They had enlisted patriotically, grateful to the American Republic for rescuing them from famine, from political oppression in Ireland, from a religious caste system, let's say, and into a racial caste system which favored them, gave them the vote. So this sense that, you know, that the Irish were somehow now going to be in competition in their effort to overcome discrimination and to assimilate in American society, with blacks who were now going to be able to fight for their own freedom, it was a real problem. If you look at the Irish newspapers, there was a real sense of crisis that we have volunteered, we have sacrificed our young men in this war, and suddenly the rules have been changed on us in midstream. Suddenly it's not a conservative war for the Constitution, you know, as it is, and the Union as it was, the Democratic slogan, but now it's suddenly an abolition war. And again, you talked about the desertion of troops from the army and so on. So I think it's really a watershed moment. And I call it an anti-Reconstruction riot because it also prefigures in very specific ways the kind of violence that we see with the KKK in the South, by 1868, by the post-war Reconstruction period, the lynchings from lampposts, this horrific kind of almost ritualistic violence. There's an uncanny echo. I mean, Thomas Nast even makes the parallel in one of his famous cartoons of decrying the Democratic Convention that meets in New York at Tammany Hall in 1868, and there's a cartoon saying this is a white man's government. In the background, you see the colored orphan asylum burning, which had been torched during the riots, and on the other side, a freedman's school being burned in the South with the Democratic Party represented by August Belmont, the financier, and Nathan Bedford Forrest, and of course, his bigoted view of the Irish slum denizen in New York getting together, reuniting, getting off the ropes at the end of the war. So I think, you know, that's probably the long shadow of the riots that we're going to see.
Let's bring Lincoln into it at this point of the discussion in respect to the exhibit and the occasion that brings us here, Lincoln in New York. I'm not at all sure that he knows quite what's happening at the beginning. I know he has a personal concern, as demonstrated in the exhibit. We see a copy of the telegram that he rather frantically sends his son, who was caught in New York City by his own design, traveling home from Harvard for his summer vacation in Washington, in no hurry to get there. Washington is not exactly a fun place to be in July, as we know. So he's paused in New York, and there's some excitement here. Lincoln's private secretary, William Stoddard, is here in New York and is sort of interested in watching all the events that are unfolding near City Hall, records in his autobiography what he sees and how exciting it was to see the first police forces putting down the beginnings of riot. And then, of course, Lincoln imposes martial law. Those documents are outside as well, and ultimately troops are ordered here. So just, Jim, help us track through what Lincoln knows and when he knows it, and if you would, give us your view of whether he acted properly, expeditiously, appropriately.
Well, I think Lincoln was a little bit worried about throwing more gasoline on the fire. And as a consequence, he reacted more slowly than the Union League, which was the Republican, basically the Republican organization here in New York, to declare martial law and to send in troops. And was later criticized, I think this is true, isn't it, Barnett, for having responded too slowly to the threat here. Once the troops did arrive and did suppress the riot in the fourth day, the city remained garrisoned with troops, and Lincoln refused to bow to Governor Horatio Seymour's request that the draft be postponed in New York City. And so it went forward now with the presence of a lot of troops in August. Lincoln was determined that that the riot not bring down the institutions of the government and its ability to recruit troops and expand the army and win the war. So
he was getting letters from other governors saying, postpone, postpone.
Yes.
And he's saying no.
Yeah, he's refusing to do so. So he draws the line in the sand at that. But I think he was a little bit slow to, or at least in the eyes of the establishment here in New York that was desperately trying to suppress this riot, to respond to the threat. And it may be that he was not as well informed about what was going on here as of course the people on the ground were. I don't know, Barnett, I'd yield to you on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. That although what the Union League was asking for, as you point out, was extreme and liable to just fan the flames all over again. I mean, they were talking about really coming in, you know, people, like Frederick Law Olmsted, for example, the leaders of the Union League, was suggesting that Lincoln should actually, you know, send troops, impose martial law, maybe even lynch, you know, hang the ringleaders of these riots if they could be found. It was a pretty extreme position. And what he ended up doing as a result was actually to strike a bargain that was brokered by Boss Tweed, William Tweed, who was the county supervisor, who, you know, used a favorite Tammany maneuver, which was to float lots of public money, bonds, and he created
stimulus package.
Thank you. That's it. And he created his substitute committee, which said, you know, if you are too poor to pay the $300, if you're drafted and you can't pay the $300, apply to this committee, and we will, you know, pay the exemption for you. If you choose to serve, you'll get a $300 bounty. So the idea was, and Tweed and Orison Blunt, one of the Republican members of the county supervisors, actually got on the train, went down to Washington, and got Lincoln and the War Department to agree to this, saying, look, you'll get your men, we'll get the substitutes for you, and we'll defuse this powder keg by paying for the poor. And that political settlement was really what allowed the draft to resume. I believe it was August 19th, and Tweed and his partisans were out there in the local draft offices in every district, calming people and telling them what the new deal was.
Sort of a triple irony in a way, because Jefferson Davis gets some credit by some for heroically standing up in the midst of a riot. Admittedly, it was a riot of Southern belles who wanted bread, but personally using his leadership skills to put down a riot where Lincoln stays very much away. Instead, the person who tries to do something personally is Governor Seymour, who begins his importuning to quell the riot with the unfortunate phrase, my friends, and that's used against Seymour and the Democrats for years, right? Because he called them friends. One of the most exciting discoveries that we made along the road to the Lincoln in New York show, it may be that I was the only one who was excited about it, because I'm always looking at ways that people of the period used Lincoln images. It's so hard to come by that information. There was a moment in the draft riots when people were ransacking a townhouse and found the Lincoln print portrait on the wall and threw it out of the window, whereupon the rioters in the street stomped on the glass and tore it and desecrated it, and it's an unusual find. So in a way, it's an anti-Lincoln riot as well, isn't it?
Very much so. And, you know, when the Union League came to Lincoln after the riots, one striking phrase that he used, he said, what can I do? I'm sitting on two volcanoes. Which is a great image for a leader who's got fighting a civil war on one hand, and he has the city exploding against him right in what were within the borders of what were the so-called loyal states. So very much a direct challenge to Lincoln. And, you know, you mentioned Seymour's rhetoric, calling them my friends. Another famous, you know, slip of the tongue or unfortunate quote from him was that before the riots broke out, I believe it was on July 4th, he was giving an oration at the music hall on 14th Street, and he was sort of lecturing Lincoln and saying, indirectly, and saying, you know, beware that the emergency policy of, the policy of national security, national emergency, of doing whatever you have to do for the cause of national security can be invoked, by a mob as well as by a government. And so some people seized on that, saying that the governor had actually was predicting these riots or even may have, in some outrageous way, have been behind them. So, again, Seymour got into some hot water.
I want to make sure we have a good chunk of time for questions, because I feel we have many people who are interested and haven't had the chance to ask anything yet. So if anyone's ready, we can begin the question period. I'm going to look particularly to this side. You, sir, you haven't asked anything. Yes. Is there a... Here he is, running again.
Over here.
The man in blue.
I was just kind of wondering, the religious aspect of this particularly, to what extent, if any, did the local political leaders who were trying to keep the peace reach out to the Catholic hierarchy to try to get them to then reach into their parishioners to calm things down? Did that happen? Did an attempt get made? Or did it backfire?
Good question. Barney,
do you want me to try that?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually on the streets of New York, you could see Catholic priests who, they hadn't exactly been invited, but it seemed that on their own initiative, were going around and appealing to various groups that were roaming the streets, looting, and trying to talk them down from the violence. So the Catholic priests on the, sort of in the lower level of the hierarchy were right out there risking their lives. The controversy about the role of the Catholic Church really came up surrounding the role of Archbishop John Hughes, who was a very militant, combative advocate for the city's, particularly for the city's Irish Catholic community. And, since the 1840s, when he came along, assumed the role in New York, he had been fighting for their rights in public schools and in all kinds of different ways to try to, balance the curriculum, which was heavily Protestant. And what happened during the riots is that Hughes didn't come out to address the mobs really until, I believe it was Friday, when things had pretty much calmed down, essentially were over. And he took a lot of criticism for that, and people said, he could have saved lives if he'd come out, done it sooner. Now, to look at it from Hughes's point of view, and I think the reason he didn't come out sooner, and if you look at the words of the speech that he delivered from the balcony of his residence, his argument was, look, this is not an Irish riot. If you're appealing to me and telling me it's my role to quell this thing, then what you're doing is putting words in my mouth or making me adopt this assumption of guilt on the part of the Irish per se. This is not an Irish riot. And so he was, in a sense, withholding his role as pacifier. He didn't want to inculpate the Irish specifically. So that was the kind of tension that he was dealing with. And certainly, there was an attempt by extremists to paint this as an Irish riot. But even some of the most ardent Republican journals, The Nation, tried to, discourage that idea and said, look, this is essentially a political riot. If they were Irish, they were here as Democratic foot soldiers.
I think it's important to remember that not only there were many Irish in New York on the other side. Many of the police were Irish. In the militia regiments that eventually returned, a lot of them are Irish Catholics. So it's not as if the Irish were a monolithic community on the side of the rioters. It divided the Irish community as well.
If I can just throw in there, the man who was the assistant provost marshal for the U.S. government in charge of enforcing the draft in the Southern District of New York, including New York City, was Robert Nugent, colonel of the Fighting Irish 69th Regiment, who was recovering from a gunshot in his leg from the Battle of Fredericksburg. So talk about a man caught in the middle.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm wondering, at what age children left school to become laborers? Were most of these rioters children? Were they teenagers? The draft drafted from 20 to 45, which is an interesting scope.
Another good question. Jim, you want to try that first?
Well, New York had no compulsory school attendance law at that time, I don't believe. I think Massachusetts was the first state to pass one that required children to stay in school until they were 14, and that was in the 1850s. But most of this legislation came after the Civil War in most states. So there was no way of keeping children in school, and a lot of them did leave school when they were 12, 13 years old. especially among the poor members of the community, to go to work. Barnett can answer the question about the age constitution of the rioters. I think that it mobilized a very large percentage of the population, from teenagers on up to people in their 40s and 50s, and it also mobilized a lot of women, yeah, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. But there's also the one harrowing, unforgettable story of the riot that maybe is the most searing, aside from the attack on the orphan asylum, is the story of the little boy who engages in genital mutilation against an African American, and that's reported in all the press. But Barney, what give your take on the age?
Yeah, I would second that. I mean, when you read the anecdotes, the primary sources from the riots, you do have a sense that this Pandora's box was opened, and it was sort of free reign for very poor people to start looting. And so there were women with small children who were going around. These people were so poor that they were just stealing anything in sight that they might be able to resell later. You know, one of the tragic stories of the immediate aftermath was that there were children picking through the charred remains of a building, small children, looking for lumps of coal from the burned timbers so that they could warm themselves in the winter. You know, I mean, that gives you some idea of the depth of poverty, and that some of these children were killed when the superstructure collapsed on top of them. So it was really this scene of mayhem with small children and women. And remember, these children were often working, you know, at an apple stand, or, you know, the famous hot corn girl of the period, right, selling hot corn on the street. You see that in some of the fiction of the era, or, you know, in prostitution. But there was this, as Jim has pointed out, the laws against child labor were essentially non-existent, and so there was a lot of it.
Other questions? Yes, on the aisle.
Hi, I was just wondering what the response was for Northern soldiers on the front. You were talking about they're on a metaphorical high, if not a literal high, both at Vicksburg as well as after Gettysburg, particularly for those who were Irish. And also, small other little question, what's the response of prominent African Americans in the Northern community?
Well, the soldiers almost universally saw this as a stab in the back, as something in the interest of the rebellion. They would be the first, I think, to subscribe to this conspiracy theory that this was fomented by the rebels as in order to light a fire in the rear while they were trying to put down a rebellion in their front. And that included Irish-American soldiers, by the way. Barnett quotes Peter Welsh, who was a sergeant, I think, in the 28th Massachusetts, one of the Irish Brigade regiments, who writes to his wife just denouncing these rioters in New York and expressing chagrin and even shame that the Irish were participating in this riot. And I think that reflected the attitude of Northern soldiers almost 100%, I would say. Certainly in the letters that I saw, they saw this as a stab in the back. And Irish black African Americans saw this as an attack, as a race riot. I think there's no doubt about that, and also they escaped as much as they could and took refuge in police stations, in other government institutions,
and Roosevelt Island across the river.
And yeah, that's right. But the residents of New York, African American residents of New York, were almost completely. I mean, I don't know if any of them were left in the immediate aftermath of the riot. They departed, and once things settled down, many of them never came back.
That's right. Yeah. The people who were left in terms of the leadership of the black community in New York, you know, people like ministers, the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, for example, he was one of the people who was instrumental in ministering to this injured community in the wake of the riots, going, you know, out to Brooklyn or New Jersey or into Westchester to find these people who had fled, try to bring them back into the city, help them, you know, get damages from the city government if possible. And what's interesting to me was to read their reaction, thinking also of James McCune Smith, who was the first accredited black physician in the United States, who happened to be also the attending physician at the colored orphan asylum that was burned. And he and Garnett and others You know, one might have expected angry words at the Irish community, perhaps. But instead, what I found was that they blamed the riots on the Democratic newspapers. That these organs of the media, of the press, they said, had been beating this drum of labor competition and this racial competition for so many years that these riots were kind of the natural fruit of that long kind of hectoring of the white working class. And Garnett in particular, you know, talked about going to Ireland and sharing the stage with Daniel O'Connell and other Irish leaders who were lobbying for the emancipation of Irish Catholics and saying, I was treated as a complete equal. So their idea was that somehow the Irish were transformed by crossing the ocean by these unscrupulous demagogues.
I think we had a question from this young woman right on the aisle here.
Good afternoon. You've touched on a few of the issues, but my question was, how long did it take to for New York City to heal politically, socially, but most importantly, economically, from those riots?
Well, the scars from the riots, if you're talking about social problems, could be measured in one respect in that there continued to be an exodus of the black population really all the way up until 1870, till the end of the decade. And then, of course, with the 15th Amendment and black voting rights, you started to see a turnaround in that process. But the scars really remained, I think, for decades. And, you know, part of my perception is that the Democratic Party, in the immediate aftermath of the riots, made a show of prosecuting the rioters, bringing them before a magistrate, sending some of them away for token periods of time, sentences, you know, hardly over 6 months, mostly. And it was really a kind of demonstration of, we're Democrats, but we believe in law and order. And so they reaped a kind of benefit from it, but at the same time, they didn't prosecute their people who were essentially their constituents, their power base, for very hard. And
was there any it was an interesting point raised. Were there any insurance claims, any payouts to anyone?
There were. I mean, legally, I think it started with the Astor Place riot in 49. The city was responsible for damages in a civil disorder like this. Of course, it was a white supremacist local government, and they essentially paid very little to blacks unless they really kept at it. But yeah, the city did financially was responsible. There were scores of buildings that were burned down. If it hadn't been for a fortuitous rainstorm early in the week, a lot more would have burned. But you know, I think the larger point is that in terms of the city's evolution, its healing from this process, I think it took really decades because I started to describe earlier this long shadow of the riots. It instilled in the upper classes an even greater fear of the working class and of the slums and incited even more stringent laws against labor strikes and so on. So in that sense, you know, it was a negative. But also the Democratic Party started to pull itself back together. It had been on the ropes during the whole Civil War. In the wake of the war, you see Boss Tweed and other local leaders, Manton Marble, of the editor of The World, a Democratic mouthpiece, Samuel Tilden, who was his handler almost. This Democratic organization gets back on its feet and, of course, fields a candidate essentially wins the 1876 election. And so, in a sense, the whole agenda of Reconstruction in New York City is really a dead letter by 1877, 14 years after the riots. And that's something that will, you know, result in Jim Crow and segregation for another 80, 90 years throughout the country, as New York actually really took a leadership role in the Democratic Party at that time.
Mm-hmm. All the way in the back, that gentleman there.
Before the Civil War, New York City had strong commercial ties with the South. And I think it was Mayor Wood wanted the city to secede from the Union. And I wondered if he was behind the riots or his people were behind the riots.
Jim, I'll let you do
that. Well, Fernando Wood, the 1861 mayor of New York, and his brother Ben Wood were certainly very prominent in the New York Democratic Party and became very prominent copperheads that is, peace Democrats during the war itself. Yes, New York City had very strong economic ties with the South. The banking structure in New York, the mercantile structure in New York, helped to finance the cotton trade, the insurance for the shipping to the South, markets for New York City's products, or products that were shipped through New York City to the South in the antebellum period. For the slave society and the slave plantations. So New York City probably had closer ties to the South than pretty much any other part of the North, maybe Cincinnati, St. Louis, but there's no doubt about that. And also the relationship between the Democratic establishment in New York City, which dominated the politics of the city itself, it was very closely allied with Southern Democrats, the so-called Breckinridge Democrats, those who supported John C. Breckinridge in the 1860 presidential election, that four-party election. The Southern Rights Democrat were probably stronger in New York City than any other part of the North. So there was a very close connection there, yes.
And there is a wonderful scene that unfolds at City Hall, the very same City Hall we have now, where Mayor Wood officially greets President-elect Lincoln over George Washington's desk, which is still there in the so-called governor's rooms of City Hall. And Lincoln knows by that point that Wood has publicly advocated creating some kind of a city-state that would be free to continue commercial ties with the South. Whether that's secession or not is sort of open to question. Lincoln says, I reckon it's not possible for the back door to set up housekeeping on its own terms. That's his private way of dismissing it. But I think it's an accurate story. I can't resist asking the man who's perched up there to ask this. I want to see,
you gotta see how him run up the stairs.
That.
Yeah. No.
This is how he does his exercise.
Question about the results of the riots as it pertains to the establishment of a professional police and fire department and the hiring of ex-Civil War soldiers, Irish soldiers, as police and firemen.
That's a good question. Bart, did you know how that unfolds?
The results of the riots, its impact on the hiring.
Creation of civil service and more unified, I mean, it certainly police, helped unify
right.
the uniformed services.
Right. One problem, of course, was that it was firemen, the Black Joke Company, number 33, that had actually triggered the riots. The police and firemen believed that they were going to be exempt. You know, traditionally, militia and police and firemen would have been exempt from a draft, and were angry to find one of their members' names had been drawn. And that's when they brought their pump with piles of rocks on it, and started the whole conflagration at 46th and 3rd on the first day. And so there was a sense of rowdiness. You know, there was this sort of tradition of getting into fistfights with other companies and so on. And also, you know, that the Democratic Party really used the police and fire department as a kind of mill for bringing men up from, you know, from the slums through the ranks into the sort of quasi-welfare state that they had running, and giving them jobs and so on. And so the Republicans definitely tried to attack that whole infrastructure in the wake of the riots, and, you know, warning them that they were going to unify the fire department into a single, you know, professional force instead of having all these maverick volunteer companies. And, you know, there was a board of health that was formed to try to deal with the slums I think it was 1866. So there was a slew of reforms that went in that was targeted at that kind of culture and trying to bring it under a Republican reign. And of course, you know, you mentioned the police. Of course, the story there is that, you know, part of the tension during the riots was that the Republicans had essentially put in their own police force. You know, they had taken control of the state government in 1856, and then proceeded to create this five-man police board. And, I mean, as you may know, there was literally a riot on the steps of City Hall as the new Metropolitan Force came in and had, you know, was fighting with billy clubs against the municipals who were backed, essentially, Fernando Woods' police force, which eventually had to give way. So, you know, the politics of the time definitely, you know, seeped into these realms, and there was an effort to gain greater control after the riots.
You know, I think what we have gleaned today, thanks to our wonderful panelists and also to your participation, not to mention the earlier panels today, is that this is a very, very complicated, painful story. To get this city and this country to where it was in 1863, from where it was in my favorite year, 1858, was extremely difficult. And I think we have learned a great deal about that era today. I thank our panel and thank all of you.
See how the boys in power try to use the working man against the working man? Once in a while, the working man gets out from under and lets them know what he thinks. And that was what happened in New York City. And here again, it was the black thing, emancipation, that triggered it. They're always going to be a problem. They're never going to cease being a problem as long as we live side by side. Much of this chemistry could be seen as some future type uprising in this country, and I can see it as a possibility, although it would be much, much larger and probably take in most of the major cities of the country. But we'll see how things go. You never know. That's it for today, 14-5, and I'll see you down the road a ways.